Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. The timpani is the heartbeat of the orchestra, but it's always relegated to the background. This hour, we bring you one man's mission to bring the kettle drum to the fore. Think about it. What song would you like to hear a solo timpanist perform?
I think a timpanist would do really well with a song from Carousel, If I Loved You.
A loud song. A really loud, strong song.
Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen.
Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin.
Beyonce, Crazy in Love.
I'm so in the holiday spirit, I'm just going to go with We Three Kings.
Dun, 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 ba-ra-ba-bum-bum, that song.
Jingle Bells all the way.
That'd be a good one.
Da, 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 ba-ra-ba, that song. Little Drummer Boy, I think it is.
I bet he gets requests for that all the time, this time of year.
Not as many as for Stairway to Heaven. Those voices no. come from Chicago, St. Louis, and St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, it's been a deadly few days in Iraq. Yesterday in the Diyala province, northeast of Baghdad, separate car bombs killed 25 people. That Sunni area has seen growing violence despite falling levels elsewhere. The people in our next story are from the other side of northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, and they've made a long journey to Lincoln, Nebraska. And that's where we begin this hour. There are 300 members of the ancient religious sect Ezidi living in Lincoln. It's their largest community in North America. Reporter Avishai Artsy met one family as they prepared for the holiday called Ezid.
When you come up to the north side of a gray duplex, it looks like any other home in this working-class Lincoln neighborhood.
Hello. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
But step inside and you find men with beards and mustaches sitting cross-legged on pillows and smoking cigarettes. Kawal Hassan offers me a steaming cup of sweet Iraqi tea. He's the unofficial leader of the Ezidi community here, and right now they're all getting ready to celebrate their big holiday. The Ezidis call their god Ezid, and on the holiday of Ezid, they remember when he appeared to them as a bright light in the sky around 6,000 years ago. That places the founding of their religion well before the Judeo-Christian tradition. This year, Ezid starts at 3 a.m. on Tuesday with an early meal, followed by a short nap. Kawal's daughter Layla says they won't eat or drink again until sundown.
We get up around 7 a.m. and before the sun comes out, then wash our face and pray.
In the morning prayer, Kawal recites the names of the seven angels and their leader, the peacock angel. For 3 days, the Ezidis fast and pray, asking for forgiveness and for peace. They haven't seen much of that. The Ezidis are a religious minority in a rough part of the world, and they keep count of all the times they've been invaded throughout history. Things didn't get any better under Saddam Hussein. Around the time Layla was born, 19 years ago, her father and several other Ezidi men were rounded up by Iraqi police. They put Kawal Hassan in prison for 45 days. There he says he was beaten, shocked with electrified cables, and immersed headfirst in ice-cold water.
They thought that we were too religious to connect it to our religion, and they would find any excuse to take us.
When the first Gulf War broke out 2 years later, Saddam Hussein began forcing Ezidi men to join his army. Kawal decided to make a run for it. He and his family hid in caves until they could make it across the border into Syria. They lived there for 7 years in a United Nations refugee camp.
They brought us blankets and they would help us, but still we didn't have a future. The bread that they brought us was full of bugs and stuff. I remember all that.
And the Ezidis remembered their religion and traditions. They still fasted for 3 days on Ezid. On the fourth day, Layla and the other children would sing and dance and collect candy from the other Ezidis.
I would get up early in the morning, take one of the bags that we get from the store, and visit every camp that was in the village. I would visit it and ask for candy.
Layla's family made it to the U.S. in 1998, but their problems didn't go away. It's hard for them to explain their religious restrictions to people in Lincoln. They don't wear the color blue because they believe it offends God. They don't eat lettuce. And on the rare occasion their religion makes the news, it's because of something horrible. On one day last August, suicide bombers killed about 300 Yazidis in northwest Iraq. Kawal Hassan watched the coverage on TV and says it was like reliving a nightmare. In the face of all that, Yazidi refugees in Lincoln wonder how they can raise their children to speak Kurdish and follow their religion.
In the ghetto, there's always someone trying to take your life. You see little kids carrying guns and knives. That's similar to my childhood life. But as I grew up, I was filled with anger, praying to the Lord so he would send me an angel. And I'm sorry, Lord, I came through to you. You were always true to me, so I'll be true to you.
Kawal Hassan's youngest son, Jalal, just turned 15. He's been in and out of juvenile detention for dealing drugs and stealing cars with his American friends. He finally stopped hanging out with those kids. He's turned a corner, and he's writing rap songs. He says that when he becomes a big hip-hop star, he'll put the Yazidi nation on the map.
He could take it back, so you better behave. I gotta get through to you, Lord, but I just don't know how will you teach me.
Starting Tuesday morning, Jalal says he'll be fasting with his family here, praying, and looking forward to the big feast on Friday. In Lincoln, Nebraska, I'm Avishai Artsy for Weekend America.
You can see Jalal and his father Kawal and other Yazidis in Lincoln, Nebraska at our website weekendamerica.org.
Thank God takes the life that he gave him right back. So forgive me, Lord, for I have sinned. I don't want to live the rest of my life in the pen. I grew up in the projects, then I went to jail all alone in my cell. And I asked myself, am I still alive or did I die and go to hell? And every single morning, man, I wake up ashamed. And every day I feel like I'm wrapped up in chains. Now every night and every day I pray, asking the Lord to let me see the light.
I'm going through TV withdrawal.
You are? What are you missing the most?
Well, I used to live for Thursdays, but now with the writer's strike, my favorite shows like 30 Rock, The Office, Letterman, they're all in reruns. Mm-hmm. And I notice it's changing my habits. I actually went bowling on a weeknight recently, and I'm totally up to date on my podcasts.
I know what you mean. It's like, of course I miss Sarah Silverman and her sister Laura, but my family is also nice, you know? And I discover that. So
well,
important.
If the strike goes on well into 2008, it may affect more than our personal relationships and our entertainment habits. You know, after all, fewer people are watching TV. That means fewer people are seeing what? Campaign ads. So the strike could affect the search for the next president. Well, that's what Foreign Policy Magazine contributor Travis Dobb blogged this week. He had a post that was titled, Six Reasons the Hollywood Strike Could Change the 2008 Election. Welcome to Week in America, Travis.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Who does that benefit if people are checking out and not seeing those campaign ads?
I think it helps the people, the candidates who are currently drawing very low in the polls, because those campaign ads are useful for the front runners to just continue to sort of pound their names home.
What about the late night talk shows? You know, that's always a place where candidates can kind of come in, sit on a couch, show that they have a sense of humor, you know, show a different side. What's the absence of Leno and Letterman? How is that playing in on the election?
The late night talk shows, they're sort of the first place where everyone is feeling this. Jay Leno and David Letterman's monologues every night rely heavily on what happens on the campaign trail. And we don't have anyone commenting on $400 haircuts. In the same way, the late night shows help to develop popular caricatures of the candidates. Amy Poehler has nailed Hillary Clinton on Saturday Night Live, and it's not a very appealing portrait of Hillary Clinton. And it's kind of unfortunate that we won't have another 7 or 8 months for her to develop that character. It might be fortunate for Hillary Clinton, certainly, that she won't be there.
You know, I remember when West Wing was out, people actually had to be reminded, Martin Sheen is not really the president, you know.
Right.
And I think on 24, people are kind of getting caught up with security issues. And it makes Americans even more afraid, perhaps, of biological threats or, you know, someone's going to blow up Los Angeles or whatever the plot du jour is. Does that actually play into which candidates get favored?
I think it does. I think that 24, for instance, paints the world in a very black and white sort of way, the way that the Bush administration has often been criticized for viewing the world. And it's kind of nice how things conveniently wrap up at the end of the season or at the end of an episode. And I think that, you know, many people look at the legal system the same way through Law and Order, that it's kind of a three-step process, and mm-hmm. then you get a conviction at the end.
Do any other shows come to mind that you think could affect elections if they get back into swing on time?
One thing that I was wondering, and I kind of joked about in this post, is that will the candidates take advantage of some of the other shows that are available now? I wonder if we'll see Hillary Clinton cooking with Rachel Ray, or mm-hmm. you know, Mike Huckabee doing a guest appearance on The Biggest Loser, talking about his weight loss experiences. So in terms, it's very difficult to predict what sort of fiction TV shows could come back and have a major impact. I was trying to boil down this entire exploration of what a world with no TV writers means to politics. And I think it means that the smaller issues become more important, because we can dissect them more carefully during the debates because more people will be watching. We can dissect them more carefully on television news programs because there will be more of them. And it'll be harder for candidates to sort of steamroll the other candidates via huge television ad campaigns, or even via sort of the collective conscience of people all tuning into a program like 24.
Travis, I appreciate you sharing your insights with us, and I look forward to more election coverage as the strike goes on.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Travis Dobb is a contributor for Foreign Policy magazine. You can find a link to Travis's blog. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
An Iran reversal, a mortgage freeze, and proof of chip superiority? Good news, bad news, no news is next on Weekend America. You're listening to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. The weekend is for reflection. Every Saturday, we look back at some of the week's events and notice whether they feel like good news or bad news or not news. With me this week, conceptual and performance artist Damali Ayo. Hey, Damali.
Hello.
Writer David Rakoff. Hello, David.
Hello.
And writer-producer John Ridley. Hey, John.
Hey.
Our first topic, a stunning reversal this week from the American intelligence community. Now they say Iran stopped pursuing nuclear weapons 4 years ago. But is it good news, bad news, or no news?
I'd say no news.
How could this possibly be no news?
You have an intelligence estimate that's saying we don't know. They say with, I think, modest certainty.
Moderate confidence.
Moderate confidence, which is, you know, the response I got from every girl I dated in high school about whether or not we'd have a second date.
Yeah.
And I honestly, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I think at this point, this administration cannot end quickly enough, because they don't have certain information, and regardless of whatever information they get in, the drumbeat is the same. Tell us what you got, or we're going to be at your doorstep.
You know, and it's potentially good news in that it might slow the march to war. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, the last Middle Eastern ruler who said that he did not have nuclear weapons ended up, what happened to him?
Yeah,
dead.
It didn't help.
So,
yeah.
You know, and it might actually put a bit of a thorn into the Giuliani's campaign with his, you know, Norman Pothart's fueled plan to invade Iran as quickly as possible, essentially on January 2nd, 2009.
So you're all over the news map.
I am. I don't know myself anymore. I look in the mirror and I'm see a stranger.
You're a house divided against itself.
I think in some ways that it's good news in that I just feel like the world is getting tired of this complete double standard. And I really am either everybody gets nukes or nobody has nukes. Like, it can't be, you know, the select club and everybody else gets bombed.
Do you prefer one or the other?
You know, it's curious because it kind of comes down to the whole, like, gun control argument. It's just gun control on a larger level, really, you know. So, you know, they have these towns where everybody gets to have a gun and all of a sudden there's no violence. So I actually don't know which way goes better. I mean, I'm a nonviolence advocate, but, you know, you can be armed and nonviolent, maybe. I don't know. It's curious to me.
Let us move on. Here's our next topic. This week, President Bush fought the foreclosure crisis with a 5-year freeze on adjustable mortgage rates. So instead of bumping up, they'll remain at the teaser rate. It's called the teaser freezer. Is it good news,
Ooh,
bad news, or no news?
The teaser freezer is such a Pilates move right there.
We're strengthening our core as a nation.
That's true.
I like that. It's bad news. It doesn't help people who are in trouble now.
Doesn't help anybody, really.
It's going to put off the pain for people who are going to need help. It's basically a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. And the fact that we're bailing out people who didn't read the bottom line, the fact that, you know, we've got a government who wants smaller government that's moving into the bigger government business, I think that's bad news. You know, it's economic Darwinism. And let the folks who thought they were getting a great deal and were greedy and couldn't read the fine print, let them fall by the wayside. That's the American way.
I just bought a house last year,
and I have a feeling you'll be fine. I have a feeling you'll be fine.
Are you kidding? Have you seen the piles of paperwork? I mean, there's piles and piles of paper that you sign. I mean,
I have people look at that stuff for me, so I can't feel.
Uh-huh. Well, then you probably also have no problem paying your mortgage.
So, Damali, you don't blame the people who took a risky loan?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think we can't throw them all into one category.
The thing about the adjustable, the subprime mortgage, is that it got a lot of people to buy homes for the first time. And we're talking about a lot of people who nothing, who have a little bit of something now. So for them, you know, it's somewhat good news.
And hopefully this will actually teach the lenders a lesson.
But it won't teach the lenders a lesson. I mean, this is the thing, is that this is something that was essentially foisted upon a credulous public with fine print. And there is no message being sent to the, you know, this somewhat extortionary industry that says, perhaps you actually might not dangle this carrot, which then turns into, I don't know what the metaphor is, turns into a viper.
I mean, you're going to be relieving a lot of people who absolutely jumped in to take their shot at grabbing the brass ring and fell off the horse, and now we got to pick them up.
The White House says it's good news because it'll help prevent a recession.
I don't think it really attacks the fundamentals of what's wrong in this country. I mean, the fact that, you know, I mean, we're spending all this money on the war, we're not raising taxes. I mean, you want to fight a recession, you really got to attack the fundamentals.
Okay. All right, our final topic. New research shows that young chimpanzees consistently outperform adult humans in a memory test. The chimps have a kind of photographic memory. The Japanese researcher speculates that humans used to have this, but we gave it up when we developed language. Does that strike you as good news, bad news, or no news?
No news.
No news?
I don't know. Unless you can actually put it to use, like, cut to some suburban home, you know, 2 years from now. I was like, oh, Mr. Noodles, where did I put my keys? Oh, there they are. Thank you. What would I ever do without you? I mean, here's the thing. They could have the best memories in the world. Uh-huh. They're still going to put feces in the toaster. They're chimps. You know, this is not news.
Okay.
But I think it's good news because anything that takes down the hubris of humanity a notch is good news.
John?
It's bad news, Bill. How long have I been doing the show with you, Bill? 15 years?
Something like that, yeah.
15. And how many stories on monkeys have we done where the monkeys are clearly moving ahead of the human race? Yeah. Now the monkeys remember more. Yeah. 10 years from now, oh, the monkeys have got the nukes. And people are all worried about Iran and this and that. kill the monkeys. Just get rid of them while we have a chance, before they can remember that we burned down the rainforests. Why is this the last story, Bill? Why are you perhaps you're in league with the monkeys. Oh, Monkey Master, remember? I'm on your side, Monkey Master. Remember, you have the great memory. It's Bill. Wait.
I was on your side.
For God's sake, kill the monkey. Please.
Okay.
Good night. I'll be home week four. Thank you. Tip your waitresses.
Does no one feel like good news that there's a nice trade-off here? We got language, but the monkeys can remember where the termites are?
Oh, we've done so much with language, too.
Yes.
You know.
Well, yeah, we're advanced, aren't we?
Wait a minute. Am I really going to have to step in here and advocate for the human race? Yes, I actually do think we've done a great deal with language.
Yeah?
Not to be completely ethnocentric about it, but when you show me the chimp literature, I'll be given pause. Why am I defending humanity
pause
in language?
Pause or pause?
Actually, you know, I have to say, the epigraph of my last book was, in fact, an excerpt from a study about the monkeys at the typewriters.
And
would they produce Hamlet? They pressed R a lot and then defecated on the keyboard. So that's what I'm saying, is basically you might have an eidetic memory for digits, but the fact of the matter is, you know, what's in the toaster? Oh, Mr. Noodles.
That's the news this week.
More or less.
Panel, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Damali Ayo is the author of How to Rent a Negro. She's also created the Now Art Grant program to support artists generating social change. David Rakoff's latest essay collection is called Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man, and his latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes.
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Coming up, the most cruel, heartless children's song in history and what I intend to do about it. Stay tuned to Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Desiree Cooper. This weekend, the NYU Percussion Ensemble will be taking the stage. The ensemble is being led by someone who's all about timpani, which are also known as kettle drums. Those are the drums that usually can be found in the back corner of most major concert halls. Well, one man is trying to change all of that.
I'm Jonathan Haas, and I'm a solo timpanist. Timpani first caught my ear when I heard Ginger Baker on White Room playing that great little timpani solo in the background. That was the first time I heard melody played on timpani. Bar Talk certainly is one of my favorites, the Bar Talk Sonata for two pianos and two percussionists. If I could play that every night, I'd be a happy timpanist. What I'm drawn to in percussion in general, but timpani specifically, I love low frequencies. When I would go to rock concerts, or sometimes I'd be in them myself, it was that pounding bass and the bass drum. They're visceral. You can feel them. They shake a room. They shake your body. It's a real feel-good frequency. And that's why I enjoy playing the timpani, because we're way down at the bottom. I've been very fortunate in that it took me 10 years, but I prevailed, and the American composer Philip Glass wrote a timpani concerto for me. In fact, it's a double timpani concerto. It's for two timpanists in front of the orchestra, and that has really been the piece that I've been traveling the world, bringing the timpani into the forefront. Well, when you're a solo timpanist, the first question you're saying is, who cares? And the second one is, gee, I hope somebody does, or I hope somebody likes this music. Very good friend of mine, Mitch Estrin, who's a fabulous clarinet player, and he told me that when I play timpani up in the front of the orchestra, he likens it, you take your kids to the zoo and you go to the monkey house and there is an elephant standing in the monkey house. And everybody would say, is that where that elephant belongs? And one could argue that the timpani in front of the orchestra is very much like the elephant in the monkey house. It takes everybody getting a little used to. It's actually a melodic instrument that we're playing melodies on a drum. And the way that we do that is there's a foot pedal that tightens the head or releases the tension on the head, and that changes the pitch. What they're really listening to is a melody instrument, not just a percussive timbrel instrument. It wasn't my intention to be a maverick, but I can honestly say that I've had a little something to do with bringing the timpani into the forefront, and it's all in the name of just making good music and having a lot of fun doing it.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
We're glad you let us be your window to what America's doing this weekend. From Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in snowy St. Paul, Minnesota. Around here, there's absolutely no problem getting into the holiday spirit. I can just hear those sleigh bells, a ring, ring, ringing, and a jing, jing. How does it go?
I think that's about it. It's around 60 and partly sunny in L.A. today. I could use some poinsettias in my office.
Yeah, it's got to be hard to get into that holiday mindset when you're nowhere near a winter wonderland.
It is.
Well, Chella Wallace now lives in Beaverton, Oregon, but when she was 10, she spent 3 years near the jungles of Panama. And she remembers a performance that helped her usher in the holiday spirit every year.
I lived in Panama from 1970 to 1973. My dad was an Army doctor, and we were stationed in Ancon in the Canal Zone on the Pacific side. How our parents explained to us how Santa got to us, because there wasn't snow, and the rooftops of our houses were very, very steep. What they told us was that Santa came down to us on a surfboard. We kept up the American traditions of putting lights on our houses, and we would go caroling every year, even though we weren't freezing and walking from door to door and getting hot chocolate. I do remember getting cookies. I think people offered us sodas or ice water. One of our neighbors had a pickup truck, and we would all pile in the back, and there were probably 10 or 12 of us all packed in, all these skinny little kids, in our shorts and our t-shirts and sitting knee to knee, and someone would print out sheets of lyrics, and we would all huddle together and drive slowly through the neighborhood, stopping at the different houses when people came out or came to the window, and we would sing Christmas carols. I remember somebody had some sleigh bells. The part that everyone would belt out on would be, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. Hey, jingle bells, jingle bells. That part, the hay part. Riding around in the back of a pickup truck, singing at the top of our lungs, even though it was very casual, and we certainly weren't terribly concerned about how well we sang, we still felt like it was a performance because we were doing something for our neighbors and sharing with our neighbors something that we didn't do, especially a whole group of us together. And we got giddy, we got silly. When people would miss words, we'd all start laughing. But at the same time, we wanted to do well and share our enthusiasm and joy and happiness with our neighbors. Living in Panama was, those were the best 3 years of my childhood. It was just so much fun. I ended up with my name, Chela, from having lived there. I picked it up as a nickname from having lived there. And that's one way that I today still honor my experience there.
There's a picture of Chela as a kid at Christmas. Just go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
We want to know about you. What is your holiday performance story? Your family tradition of showmanship, or a story of your first nutcracker, your first office party talent show performance, you know, forgetting your lines in the play. We'd like to hear it.
Well, my son remembered all of his lines one year, but he forgot to get on the stage. He was sitting with us in the audience when he realized he was in the wrong spot.
Top that. Send us your stories, weekendamerica.org. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke. These days, I spend my weekends protecting my baby daughter, protecting her from falling, choking, and being miserable for very long. I figure this is my job. Well, now I have a dilemma. I was driving home listening to a children's music CD that a friend gave me when I heard this.
Puff the magic dragon lived by the sea.
You remember the tune? Starts out very happy. In fact, I've been polling my friends. Almost everyone remembers this as a cute little kiddie song. But as I kept listening, my car turned into my parents' living room circa 1972. I could see the wooden cabinet stereo with the record spinning inside. See, I was a troubled little kid, and I lived in my imagination. This song lured me in to Hana Lee, and then it crushed me. Little Jackie Paper abandons his best friend and Puff collapses.
Without his lifelong friend, Puff could not be brave. So Puff, that mighty dragon, sadly slipped into his cave.
So I'm driving down the Hollywood freeway, not misty-eyed, but actual tears running down my face. And I realize I'm not crying for Puff. I'm crying for a little boy who I couldn't protect, who didn't know any better than to die a little inside as he found out that even your imagination is painful. So as I drove, I made two resolutions. One, I'm going to protect my daughter from ever hearing the most heartless children's song in history. And two, I'm going to find the son of a bitch who wrote it and make sure he knows what he did to me.
Oh, we found it. Okay, here it is. So here you can see the typescript. That's mine. I typed this in the typewriter.
What do you know? Turns out the son of a bitch lives a few miles from me in Los Angeles. And he's a really nice guy. His name is Lenny Lipton, and he invited me to his home and showed me his original poem from 1959 and the handwritten edits made by his friend Peter Yarrow, who later made the song a hit with Peter, Paul, and Mary.
This was lost for years, and Yarrow found it. So very few people have ever seen this. See, Green Scales Fell Like Rain. Now, that was from the original. I wrote that, huh? I never liked Green Scales Fell Like Rain, and I blamed it on Yarrow, but I can see that I wrote it.
Lenny told me the whole story. He was a freshman at Cornell University when one day he read an Ogden Nash poem called The Relio Trulio Dragon and decided to write a dragon poem himself. Why?
I don't know. It was an inspiration.
By the way, you may have heard that puff is a lightly coded reference to marijuana. Lenny says that's not what it was about.
I think it's what I was feeling. I think what I was feeling was that my childhood had ended, and this was sort of a metaphor for that. A lot of it, I think the song is about creativity, about the creativity of youth, and how when people grow up, it goes away.
Now, I could relate to all of this. Kids do grow up, and they leave behind their imaginary friends, and it's sad. But where was the redemption? Why did Puff fall apart? Why is this song so hopeless? And this is when Lenny showed me the last line of his poem, which Yarrow had crossed out. It reads, "Puff the magic dragon slipped into his cave
and waited the eventual coming of little Tommy Knave." Mm-hmm. So Tommy Knave has been assigned to oblivion and obscurity, but Jackie Paper lives on.
He's laughing about it. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. You mean it's not over? Puff finds a new friend?
Why did you let Peter Yarrow and Peter, Paul, and Mary record the song without your hopeful ending?
They didn't do anything to hurt the spirit of the song. Because the song stops doesn't mean the story stops.
I'm thinking about this because I'm a new father, a first-time father. And Reza, right now, I would protect her from that song, Lenny.
I don't know. I don't know if you would do that. Think about it. It's not going to make her life a little bit better, not worse.
Why do you think it would make...
Because all literature and art is important. It helps you make sense out of your life. Crying about Puff the Magic Dragon is... It's practice for the, you know, the loss of your first love or your parents dying.
I also don't sing my child to my child about her cradle falling out of the tree.
I think you may be creating a Buddha. Buddha's father tried to keep him from all misery. So if you keep doing that, one day your kid's going to discover that there is mortality and sorrow. And that may be quite a shock. Everybody who goes through that may not become a Buddha. They may become crazy.
Well, the man makes sense. I mean, I don't want Susanna to get sucker punched by the fist of life. But on the other hand, I also don't want to land the first blow with this song. And I know I shouldn't run her life according to my childhood sorrow. But then isn't she supposed to benefit from my experience? Well, I guess it's okay to be undecided for a while. She is only 10 months old.
If the bough breaks, the cradle won't fall, 'cause daddy will catch it, baby and all.
Where's my baby? Where's my baby?
Aww. Bill, I'm still trying to picture you as Buddha's father.
I should hope. You've got kids, Dad. As they're older now, did you want to shield them from, you know, literary misery?
Well, you know, actually, I had the exact opposite experience. When my daughter was little, I gave her a copy of my favorite book, Charlotte's Web. And then one day, mm-hmm. I heard her sobbing in her bedroom. I scale the stairs. I'm bounding up there to see what's the matter. And then I remembered Charlotte died.
Nice, yeah.
And I felt like I had suckered her into this story and then just let it explode in her face. Mm-hmm. But I guess I'm going to have to agree with Lenny. because the reason that book was my favorite, the reason it stayed with me, was because of Charlotte's death. And it really was practice grief.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can do this.
Didn't she lay a sack of eggs before she died, at least? A dinosaur egg would have helped me out. Well, there's a new Puff the Magic Dragon book out, and at WeekendAmerica.org, Lenny Lipton starts reading us the book by his fireplace until he breaks that into song.
There may be scattered showers over Pearl Harbor this weekend, but at least it'll be nearly 80. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
Seinfeld is gone, but Festivus lives on. The formerly fictional holiday is celebrated in Milwaukee with feats of strength and the airing of the grievances. Look for the Festivus pole lot so you can find the perfect unadorned aluminum stick for your family. Clouds and 25 in Milwaukee, but you'll always have irony and sarcasm to keep you warm. Mark Twain often wrote about the Mississippi River. Turns out he did a little research on the Pacific, too. Showers in 69 at the Mark Twain Festival on the Big Island of Hawaii, celebrating Twain's 19th century six-month stay on the islands. Tragically, Twain never wrote Huckleberry Finn's Surfing Adventure, thus denying the world a literary masterpiece. If you're looking for a calm, soothing weekend, avoid Lutcher, Louisiana. They have thunderstorms to go with 78 degrees, and they're lighting stuff on fire. It's the Festival of the Bonfires with live music, parades, and 100 enormous bonfires. And don't forget the lightning. The event is sponsored by the What Could Possibly Go Wrong Foundation. For information on these and other events, go to WeekendAmerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
For the prosperous people of Houston, holidays mean the hard work and high glamour of charity. Buy a table with us next on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, thanks for hanging out with us this weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. This weekend in Houston, an elderly billionaire is preparing to go to prison. A federal judge sentenced oil man Oscar Wyatt Jr. to a year and a day in prison for accepting kickbacks from Saddam Hussein's regime. The sentence was not as harsh as it could have been, the judge said, thanks to the impressive outpouring of support from the Houston community. The wealthy suburb of River Oaks is home to a vibrant social scene, and the convictions of Wyatt and last year the Enron executives are not slowing it down, especially not now in this very busy holiday charity gala season. Reporter Michael May takes a peek.
At the Chinese Community Center gala, the men are in tuxes, the women in impossibly high heels, and the fundraisers in top form. They're looking for people with fat checkbooks, but a reporter with a microphone will do.
It will be a symbolic realization of the unity of the East and the West, their differences creating an unforgettable harmony.
Audrey Hepburn spent 4 days with us in 1990 in Houston, and I asked her, I said, why do you go to Sudan and Darfur, Ethiopia? And she said, John, it's a sacred charge, it's a sacred calling.
The Chinese Community Center is fabulous. All community centers should be patterned after this one.
This talk fills the days and nights of Carolyn Farr. She's the divorced widow of a real estate tycoon. She's now better known as Houston's First Lady of Philanthropy. She claims she's in her 50s, and she looks glamorous. Tonight she works the crowd wearing an elaborate cascading Chinese headdress that frames her blonde hair in perfect makeup.
Did you see Yao Ming's father here?
Yes.
No, I didn't.
Yes. How could you miss him?
But he's very young looking, you know. He's better looking, actually, than his son.
Carolyn, more than anyone else, has defined the Houston Charity Gala for the past 3 decades. The evening begins with a silent auction, a fundraising tool that Farb introduced to Houston. Then guests are seated at large round tables and try to chat over speeches by politicians, oil executives, and a performance by a mariachi band singing in Chinese. Later, Carolyn receives a Lifetime Achievement Award during a dinner of filet mignon and crab cakes. A video about her life plays for the crowd.
In her 30 years of public service, Carolyn Farb has been changing the world one corner at a time.
The world is showbiz. You got to stand up and shout. Look at Donald Trump. He's showbiz and he's in real estate.
Carolyn's not simply a fundraiser. She also gives her own money. And she knows what motivates her fellow rich Houstonians. Praise. UNICEF's John Sacrio says that's okay.
There's a lot of anonymous giving in other parts of the country, and in Houston, people like to be known. And I think it's good to be known. I think it's important for people to know people that they look up to are giving because they're role models. They're incentives for others to give. So I think a showy giving is a good giving.
Houston charities depend a lot on showy giving, and some donors depend as much on being seen as role models. Although it wasn't enough to keep them out of jail, oil billionaire Oscar Wyatt still has a great reputation around town as a man of charity. Mimi Swartz is a writer for Texas Monthly and a longtime observer of the Houston social scene. She misses the days when Houston's rich were wild and eccentric. Now they shuffle from one gala to the next.
So they all look the same. They all talk the same. It's not like the old days where you had somebody like Joanne Herring giving a party where she hires a Boy Scout troop to dress as Nubian slaves. It's just that's never going to happen again. And I think that's sad.
So. Swartz remembers when Carolyn Farb was also part of that world. Back in the 70s, her then-husband, real estate investor Harold Farb, opened a nightclub just so he could sing on stage. But through her relentless attention to one cause after another, Carolyn has reinvented herself as a woman of taste and compassion.
Oh, hello. So glad to see you.
You look gorgeous.
I saw Jeff. This is beautiful Erica Bagwell.
It's barely 12 hours since the last gala, and Carolyn's at it again, this time at an opulent luncheon for the Houston AIDS Foundation. Until Carolyn turned her attention to it, AIDS was not on the list of trendy causes in Houston. Now the foundation is officially a couture charity.
My, what a big microphone you have. Or are you just happy to see me?
Carson Kressley from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy is the celebrity guest. He speaks at these kinds of events across the country.
What's different in Texas is that it's like a job for these ladies. You know, this is like they're already talking about next year, and we just finished eating lunch, and it's like, what are we going to do next year?
Later that day, I meet Carolyn at her large art-filled home in the wealthy suburb of River Oaks. She tells me she just sold a Frida Kahlo painting for a record price. Carolyn's still wearing her gown and leopard-spotted wrap, but she looks tired. She can't count all the galas she's attending this season.
Do I like to stand for 4 hours in the evening in high heels at these events and schmooze? Sometimes I don't, but it's all part of the thing. I mean, you've got to make them glad that they came, show them that you appreciate their support, be the guiding light, show them the way.
In Houston, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Well, Carolyn has another party to get up for tonight. It's in San Antonio, actually, at the McNay Art Museum, a wedding anniversary party for Robert and Donna Bruni, a very prominent couple. Carolyn says a lot of Houston people will be there as well. And, by the way, she's just started planning a UNICEF fundraiser with George Michael that will happen in Dallas next year. You can see Carolyn Farb and her amazing Chinese headdress at our website, weekendamerica.org.
I'm thinking it's a good thing they stopped using the Boy Scouts dressed as Nubian slaves. That's so Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced with Ben Adair, who is off to see the somewhat controversial Golden Compass this weekend. Julia Barton, Neely Allel, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan is performing at the Acadia in Minneapolis this weekend. Michael Rayfield, Susie Lechtenberg, Tim Bomba, who's visiting mom in Pittsburgh this weekend.
Also, Johnny Vince Evans, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, who's contemplating how to pay that $225 ticket he got this week. He's also mopping up his house because his roof started leaking. Phyllis Owens, Angela Kim, John Moe, who's going to be serving as transportation director for multiple overlapping children's birthday parties, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by the band Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show, and I hope you'll take us with you for free via the podcast. Very easy to do at our website, weekendamerica.org. Thanks for spending the hour with us. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here and you see a whole bunch of people in there, hey, they go Pookie, they go Mikey. You know, I didn't expect to see him here. It make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.